Afghanistan is a country mostly of deserts and mountains. A very small part of the land is irrigable agricultural land. And all invaders have found it a really difficult place to hold. The British general, famous General Wellington at the beginning of the 19th century, said a small army would not be able to hold the country and a large army would starve.
And of course, those mountains are still there and the country in its way is as it has been forever.
I think it's really easy to forget quite how important the landscape of Afghanistan is to any military tactics that happen. You've got the Northwest Frontier itself, which is 400 miles long and 200 miles wide, with peaks going up to 17,000 feet, and only three useful passes that cross it, the most famous being the Khyber Pass itself. And the British found during the 19th century that when they invaded Afghanistan, they were following the same tracks as their ancestors 40, 50 years before in the Second War, literally the military roads that they'd built, because those were the only ways that they could cross. It's natural guerrilla territory. It's not an easy place for modern technological armies to operate. And beyond it lies the deserts of Afghanistan and still further higher mountain ranges still in the Hindu Kush to the north.
So added to a very unforgiving landscape that is unforgiving to anybody who tries to enter it, you've also got a history of a weak central government, which you bring out in your description of the very first British envoy back in 1808 to meet up with the king or emir of Afghanistan.
Well, this is an extraordinary meeting. It was really the first official meeting, if you like, between any European country and the king of Afghanistan since Alexander the Great, a couple of thousand years before. But when the British took India at the beginning of the 19th century, they broadly controlled Persia, modern-day Iran, and there was this gap on the map in between British India and Persia, and that was Afghanistan. They didn't know what was there. And when this rather brilliant young Scottish envoy, Mountstuart Elphinstone, met Shah Shuja, he met a man who was wearing on a bracelet round his wrist, the Koh-i-Noor diamond, which is the symbol of kingly power in that region, had been for a couple of hundred years before. So this was a country that had been used to being great, but Shah Shuja didn't rule very much. He didn't control the country very stably because there wasn't much loyalty often to the central government. And this has been one of the constant problems in Afghanistan right from the beginning. Afghans tend to ally against a foreign enemy when the enemy comes in, but then they tend to fall apart like sand when you try and govern them from inside, and many Afghan kings have discovered that.
Which seemed to be on display quite vividly when the Soviets invaded, because the whole country, more or less, rose up against its government. The Soviets tried to prop it up. They rose up against the Soviets. When the Soviets left, they turned on each other.
Yes. I mean, the one really interesting unifying factor which led to the destruction of the Russians, and I think many historians previously have ignored quite how far back this goes, is the strong sense of Islamic Jihad, of how Afghans will rally round fundamentalist Islamic banners in order to get rid of foreign invaders. Even down to the terminology, I discovered the very first use of the word Talib as somebody who was a warrior against the British was 1880. And that really strong fundamentalist Islamic strand is one of the determinants of this way that Afghans will ally against foreign forces. And we saw it most strongly in the 1980s after the Russian invasion, Christmas 1979. And as you say, exactly what happened after the Russians left was it all fell apart again. And it took the Taliban, who emerged out of the chaos of all that as a sort of fundamentalist, rather purist group in 1995, to stop all this civil war among the feuding Mujahideen and to bring some kind of stability.
Let me, though, throw a challenge at you. You have just told us all the ways in which history might inform what's happening today, but there are many different things today that exist in Afghanistan. For instance, people are no longer so isolated there. They have the internet, cell phones, they can communicate. In addition, they're weary of war, which would affect how they think about what might be called invaders. How do you put that together with these other strains that are still strong?
I think there's a real opportunity to get Afghanistan right. There are now huge numbers of refugees who've return to the country. I think the problem is that, you know, the mobile phones, computers, the customs of returning refugees who want a different kind of future, all of that counts for nothing if the government at the centre is so corrupt that if really simple things like justice, so that you can't sort a dispute with your neighbour unless you pay for it, like not having decent land title, and the Taliban have been able to recruit a substantial support because of the ineffectiveness of the central government, even though most people in the country might want a different kind of country.
Last question. You dedicated your book to the last king of Afghanistan. Why?
Zahir Shah ruled from 1933 to 1973, which was the only period of peace and prosperity without any significant invasion by foreign forces. And I think that's quite an achievement. And I dedicated it to a memory of a time in Afghanistan when there was significant foreign involvement that was benign. There was investment in the south of the country. Afghanistan exported more raisins than California. Women in the 1960s and 1970s began to feel genuinely free for the first time. There was a Miss Kabul competition. My dedication of the book was a memory of a different Afghanistan, and perhaps an Afghanistan that could emerge again.
Thank you very much.
Renée, it's really good to talk. Thank you.